You're listening to A Light at the Other Side, where we're sharing stories of resilience, healing, and hope. We share the experiences of adoptees, domestic violence survivors, military veterans, and more, so some episodes may contain potentially triggering accounts of trauma. To fully appreciate the light, we must sometimes peer into the dark. Hi, and welcome back. On today's episode, we're going to be sharing military stories. I have a publication, Served, that features the work of military veterans. Today, I'm going to be sharing two of my pieces that reflect upon my time in the U.S. Navy. The day I decided to enlist. A pizza shop, a blue September sky, and the end of the world as we knew it. 9/11. The date, the phrase, the numbers all hold different meanings and memories for everyone. Vivid, clear memories. Some are shared. We all watched the horrific live news footage, most of us together with others, huddled around TVs in offices, lobbies, even sports bars. Nearly every American's face was pointed at a screen that day, unable to tear ourselves away. But where I was, where you were, where we each were, that's what shapes our personal relation to that day. My story is not particularly unique, but it sparked a deep transition and transformation within me. On that day, part of my youth collapsed, and I felt the shift into adulthood. At the time, I was taking a gap year from college. That is to say, I had blown my scholarship freshman year with the help of Captain Morgan and Mary Jane. I was sort of lost, floating along, still living in my college town in South Carolina, trying to figure out who I was, what I wanted, and how to get there. In the meantime, I was working an assortment of service industry jobs. The downtown pub for lunch shifts, dinner and weekends at the pizza shop, and late night bartending gigs here and there. Sometime towards the end of summer 2001, I started taking a couple of day shifts at the pizza shop, Gambino's, a kitschy pizza joint in the bar district of our college town. We had a huge wall mural of the skyline of Manhattan behind the red and chrome Formica dinner tables over black and white checkered floors. Classic NYC. Classic American-Italian. This particular morning, my alarm didn't go off. I awoke with a start and remembered I had a day shift at Gambino's, so I did a quick face wash and brushed my teeth, pulled my hair up, threw on my work clothes, and was out the door in 20 minutes. I normally listen to NPR in the morning, as I still do, but this morning I was thinking more of getting to work on time and didn't listen to a single TV or radio before arriving at work. I drove through a warm September morning, unaware I was speeding through the last moments of the before time. When I walked in, the shop was eerily quiet, dark, and cool. Typically, it was already pretty steamy as we turned on the pizza ovens to heat up as part of the opening duties, and our crew was usually busy shredding cheese, prepping veggies and toppings, filling sauces, folding pizza boxes, all backed by a soundtrack of tinny rock or rap music from the cheap boombox in the office. Today, nothing. I paused for a second and then figured I was maybe being hazed for being late and I'd have to do more than my share of the opening list. I shrugged, figured I deserved it, and went around flipping on the lights and ovens. My manager, the head pizza chef, appeared in the office doorway. His eyes were bloodshot, rimmed red, and he looked sober. I rarely saw him sober, to be honest, and it was unnerving. "Stop," he said, his voice so much quieter than I'd ever heard. "We're not opening. He paused, looking around as if to find a way to not have to say what he had to say, and also searching for words that weren't familiar to us Americans, not in this generation, not in 2001. And then his eyes came back to rest on me. "We're under attack or something. They're flying planes into buildings in New York, the World Trade Center, maybe DC too." His words trailed off as he couldn't find them. And then he turned and motioned for me to come into the office. We had a small box television with rabbit ear antennas propped on top of a filing cabinet along the wall, next to a stainless steel rack of spices and containers of flour and olive oil. Every coworker scheduled for the shift was huddled around the television, and yet I couldn't hear a thing. It was like no one was even breathing. I paused, still wondering if this was an elaborate prank, before turning my head and seeing two skyscrapers on the small screen, a cloud of smoke billowing from them. My mouth went dry and my pulse quickened. What the fuck? We're America. Who would be attacking us and why? After a couple of moments, the bell on the front door jangled and everyone jumped. A cook from the bar next door walked into the office with one hand absently rubbing the top of his head, and he cleared his throat a little before quietly inviting us to come next door and watch on, you know, the bigger screens. The place was a classic sports bar with big screen televisions every few feet behind the bar and along one wall, usually playing an assortment of ESPN offerings. That day, every single one had the same feed. The same feed everyone in America was watching, the towers smoking. Hushed news anchors trying to find words, trying to get information, sharing the same bits repeatedly with stretches of silence in between as all of us found ourselves breathless, speechless, captive. Mere seconds after we walked in, as we were all standing awkwardly just inside the doorway, a tower collapsed. We gasped, held our breath, stopped breathing, and time held pause over us as we watched the deaths of thousands of citizens live on cable news in the United States of America. I stepped back outside, breathed once, blinked, breathed twice. Inside was exploding into bedlam as my coworkers all began talking at once, their eyes large and white like a flock of animals who have seen the wolf. The door slowly closed and snuffed the sound. I pulled my cigarettes out of my bag, which I realized I was still clutching 15 minutes after walking into work. I sat down heavily on the concrete stairs leading into our restaurant. I lit one and dragged deep, and another drag, and another. Three deep drags. I stared at the street. No one was out. Nothing was moving. All was still, while through the plate glass windows of shops and restaurants, I could see them, my fellow people, their faces lit from screens as they stared up at televisions mounted on walls, behind bars, on counters, and we all watched together as our world tectonically shifted. I lit another cigarette. I looked up into the clearest blue sky, nothing from horizon to horizon, not a cloud, not a whisper of anything. No indication that this sky was host to murder and chaos and national emergency and history in the making. For a moment, we held pause. The life before held in this last breath, the life before talk of war, before security checks at every airport, before violence towards our Muslim neighbors, before everything fundamentally changed, we held our breath. I lit another cigarette. I looked over my shoulder into the sports bar. The second tower fell. My head hung in my hands. My coworkers all shoved out of the bar, seeming to gasp for fresh air. They stood in the space between our restaurants, smoking cigarettes, staring into the sky, some of them grown men, crying. One young guy bent over, his hands propped on his knees, looking to be fighting nausea. We looked to the manager and someone asked what the plan was. None of us really wanted to go home. No one wanted to be alone, I think. We stayed, we lingered, just to be with other people processing this together. Turning back to Gambino's, he opened the door and we filed in and stood in the lobby, all of us rooted to the spot, staring at the expansive, floor-to-ceiling, wall-to-wall mural of the skyline of New York. Of the twin towers still standing. Frozen in time on the wall of a pizza shop in South Carolina. Frozen in history, immortalized. Nothing felt real. And then as quickly as our lives had shifted that morning, it became pretty real pretty fast. The door behind me slammed open and a tall, stocky young black man ran in, his face unlike anything I'd ever seen. "Your phone, please, your phone, please." One of my coworkers grabbed the handset of our shop phone and thrust it in the young man's hands. His eyes were hysterical and his face wet, tears, mucus, sweat. His mother worked in the World Trade Center. He couldn't get through to her. He didn't have a cell phone. Not many of us did then. His apartment was above the restaurants, and he'd come down trying to find a phone to call her. His landline not working or not connected, something. No one asked. It was the beginning of a semester. Maybe he'd just moved in and his phone hadn't been hooked up yet. He dialed. He sobbed. He dialed again. He sat on the floor in front of the front counter, the coiled cord of the phone stretching over the edge, pulling taut as he clutched the receiver. We pulled away, distancing ourselves from it. We stepped away. We retreated to the office. We recoiled. We pulled inside ourselves. We tried to find our footing. I wish I could say his mother answered their home phone. She didn't. His aunt did. His aunt said, "Come home, baby. Come home." And he stood up, sprinted up the stairs to his apartment, retrieved his keys and wallet, ran out to the parking lot, and drove away. I never saw him again. I never found out if his mother made it out alive. He left the receiver dangling from the counter, the mechanical disconnect tone beeping into the empty room. I sat outside again, my coworkers smoking behind me under the awning. Smoking under the awning was against the rules, but it didn't feel like rules held that morning. They were quiet, pondering if there would be a military action and what kind. We lived in a city with a very large army base and training center. We wondered if they would deploy from our city, if they would deploy within the United States, if we would see military action on our streets like so many other nations have seen through the years. Someone said, "This is our Pearl Harbor, right?" I stopped cold. It was. What did that mean? What did it mean for us, those 19-year-olds, just like our grandparents who had been 19 when Pearl Harbor was attacked, and they stood up, they banded together, they stepped forward to offer themselves in defense of our nation? At that moment, I decided to do it, to step up, to make my life have some kind of value and purpose. Jim Adkins' lyrics floating through my mind, "I want to be so much more than this." I'd always thought of those moments as having a romantic nostalgia and endearing patriotism, as portrayed in movies like Pearl Harbor. But my moment didn't. It felt like a deep fire, an anger, and a resignation, an obligation, a duty. A few months passed, several months of drinking and going to emo shows and watching endless terrible news specials and reconciling the end of my youth and just what kind of sacrifice I was potentially talking about before the windy May day when I snuffed out a cigarette with my beat-up Converse, opened the door to the recruiter's office, and announced, "I'm here. Sign me up." I served 4 years in the U.S. Navy. I hold deep and enduring pride for that. For my service and my dedication, not necessarily the actions of the entire U.S. military during that time. That's a much more complicated discussion. Due to the massive response in enlistment after 9/11, I had to wait almost a year for a female bed to open up in boot camp. I spent that year making memories in between existential crises and sleepless nights convincing myself not to back out. I got tattoos. I rode around at midnight in the midst of a snowstorm and listened to Jimmy Eat World's ironically titled Bleed American album, watching Transformers blow with showers of blue sparks. I took impromptu weekend road trips to sit on the beach and stare into the abyss. I brushed off the creeping admiration of my peers who felt I was some kind of hero for signing up, but I accepted a fair amount of free beers from the sentiment. I didn't feel like a hero. I felt like I was just doing my part. The night before I shipped out, I stood in the rain with my boyfriend, literally shaking. It wasn't cold. It was an unusually warm 72 degrees on the first day of March, but I felt terror down to my bones for what lay ahead. I knew nothing would ever, ever be the same for me. In fact, nothing was ever, ever the same for any of us. One hand covering my ass, one hand in a salute. What it was really like for a female in the military just after the turn of the century. I glared steely-eyed at the smug man across the desk, the man who had lured me to his office with a trouble ticket for his printer, and upon my arrival had implied in no uncertain terms that he wanted a sexual favor. I left the space without fixing the printer, although it most likely wasn't broken, just unplugged, and stormed across a dozen frames and down two decks back to the relative safety of my desk. It was 2004, and I was serving in the U.S. Navy on board the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower, and this morning's events were not a particularly rare phenomenon for me. I had already learned which men to avoid, and since I assigned out trouble tickets, I sighed as I added our friend in the aviation department to my list of always assigned to men and closed his ticket. This was business as usual. I want to make it perfectly clear. Overall, I really enjoyed my time in the military and would have easily completed a 20-year career if I hadn't chosen to start a family instead. Life out on the sea was just the best. Sunrise over the infinite horizon with a cup of coffee and a cigarette was such a great way to start the day. The unexpected hurdles of an angry sea interfering with flight schedules and our course and not giving one single damn as she tossed around an enormous aircraft carrier like a bath toy provided an air of unpredictability to an otherwise rote military schedule. Simply put, you never knew what each day would bring. I worked with some of the best people I've ever known and am still friends with many of them to this day. I received great training and education that I used well after my enlistment was over. I learned the value of discipline and regularity. But boy, did I learn to protect my assets. Men on that ship were handsy. I learned to use my elbow and my wit to keep the most aggressive at bay. The most egregious incidents still shock me to this day, not just for the behavior of the men involved, but the blasé reaction of those around who saw the behavior and ignored it, or worse, laughed. One of the first was when I had just arrived to my first ship. I probably had been there less than a month when I met an old salty dog, an enlisted sailor who had almost finished his 20 years, had more sea time than anyone in our department, and had one foot out the door. His uniform is usually sloppy, and his breath smelled of gin, his favorite beverage. He was the living embodiment of the old Navy, when sailors were practically expected to be alcoholics and miscreants. Their shenanigans, which frequently included sexual harassment and assault, were brushed off as just the behavior of boys letting off steam. For the majority of his career, there were no women, or very few, on board most ships, despite the ruling in 1978 permitting women to serve on forward deployed warships. The first time he accidentally touched me, his hand skimmed across my chest as he reached across me to get something off a shelf. I pushed myself back out of instinct, thinking it was surely an honest mistake in close quarters, as he grinned and said, "Oops." The next few times I began to understand it didn't matter how small or big a space we were in, he was intentionally making these touches happen. So I began shielding my chest with binders, logbooks, and my bulky ship utility jacket. I also began the habit of turning away from him whenever he would be near me. That proved to be a mistake. His accidental grazes became more forceful and purposeful, and more than once I told him to knock it off. He always laughed and said that's why women were too sensitive to serve on active duty. Yet I wonder what his response would be if one of his shipmates grabbed his ass. I seethed. Finally, it reached a head. I was in my office space, standing facing the desk, organizing crypto material and binders for the day. My lieutenant was sitting at the desk. Another sailor was in the corner waiting for instruction. This older sailor walked in, saw me working, grabbed my hips and thrust his pelvis into my backside four or five times while saying, "Yeah, baby." My lieutenant, the other sailor, and the old sailor just laughed uproariously as I grabbed the binders and ran out in tears. My lieutenant yelled after me, and I paused for a moment to see if he was going to stand up for me. No, he was yelling for the binders in my arms. They contained classified material. I walked back into the office, dropped the binders on the desk, and walked out without a word. I began being a lot more bitchy after that day. I threw elbows whenever that guy or any other got too close. When I discussed the incident with a senior sailor, I was encouraged to, quote, "just try to deal with him. You wouldn't want to derail this guy's retirement, right? He served 20 years. He'll be gone soon. Just avoid him." So I dealt with him with tiny, petty acts of aggression. I found opportunities to drop things on his lap, heavy things, or stomp on his foot while passing in a tight P-way. His logbook mysteriously went missing, as did the bottle of gin that was hidden, not really, in a lower desk drawer. I didn't wake him when he fell asleep on watch and watched him get his ass chewed out for it. I smiled real pretty for him, though, when he glared at me after the watch officer left the space. Oops. A little taste of vindication. I didn't attend his retirement or the party afterward. No one asked why. If it wasn't sexual, it was anger. Soon enough, he was gone, but that didn't mean I was past the attention and ire of my male shipmates. Besides the small acts of sexual harassment, the butt grabs, the pats and rubs, and accidental grazes, was the seething anger of some of the strangest men I've ever met. Men absolutely filled with rage against women. They didn't believe women should serve in the military, and they love to let you know it. Once I was in a space doing some manual labor while our ship was in the shipyards. I was grinding the deck. It's where you take a power tool, like a grinder, and grind paint off the deck. An enormous part of our department's time was spent grinding the deck for several months during my first year as the ship was rehabbed and refitted during a major overhaul. She was stripped back almost to the ribs for this $1 billion renovation. Another junior sailor and I were doing the actual work while a petty officer second class supervised, meaning he sat on a chair and watched. And for clarification, petty officer is not officer. It's an enlisted rank, which was two ranks higher than my rank at the time. Due to the renovations, there were no functioning heads, bathrooms, on the ship. So we had to leave the ship and walk across the shipyard parking lot to the floating office barge we were using for administrative purposes, the barge which also housed heads and berthing with racks for overnight duty. As a female sailor, this meant getting your period was inconvenient at best, nightmarish at worst. So, of course, I get my period 3 days early, Natch, while being supervised by a redheaded rage machine from Alabama who really despised women in general, but especially women who had the audacity to volunteer to enlist in their military and serve their country. In fact, I'd been listening to him rant about what a piece of shit I and every other female on board was for taking a rack from an able-bodied man as I ground asbestos-laden paint and metal from the deck while he sat in a chair doing nothing. The irony, right? So, of course, the moment I felt the familiar deep ache and cramp that hits my lower abdomen about 20 minutes before blood flow, I sighed, knowing how this was going to go. I mean, I could guess, but I couldn't really be aware of how much this guy hated women. I sat up, peeled off my gloves, and stood up to leave and head over to the barge. PO2 jumped to his feet and was in my face within seconds. "Where do you think you're going? I didn't say you could stop. Get back down on that deck and finish working." I'll also pause here for those non-military types to reiterate that within the U.S. Navy, being yelled at after basic training is pretty rare. It's not common. We don't continue to speak to each other the way division commanders yell at recruits in boot camp. It's just not done. If you're in trouble, you may get yelled at, but it would be for a pretty big infraction and coupled with actual action, like a write-up. What this guy was doing was entirely out of pocket and not normal for this type of interaction on the ship. For all intents and purposes, we usually interacted normally like professionals in an office setting. I quietly explained where I was going and that I needed to go then, unless we wanted to clean up more than old paint on the deck. He was in my face. I suddenly felt how tight the space was and stepped back from him, and he stepped to me again. His face was beet red, and he was literally panting and sweating as he unleashed a stream of profanities and ranting about, "This is exactly why women shouldn't serve. If I knew my period was coming," boy, did he know a lot about female anatomy and biology, "I should have stuffed it already." And the angrier he got, the more I became acutely aware that this guy was about to hit me or throw something at me. He was completely out of control. The sailor working with me stood up. He was a big guy, and in some scenarios, physical size speaks more than rank. Men just know when they're outmatched. He was the strong, silent type too, so all he did was stand up and stare down the psychotic, raving PO2 until the yelling trickled off and he cursed as he slammed the chair backward onto the floor and stormed out of the space. I cried. The sailor beside me put his arm around me for just a moment and then let go, and I practically ran out of the space, aft dozens of frames, down two decks, and out onto the gangplank. I slowed to a walk so I didn't attract attention from the watch officer on duty, steadied my steps to walk normally down the plank, across the parking lot, into the barge, up into the makeshift female berthing, before I sat down heavily on a chair and let out a deep, deep breath I hadn't realized I'd been holding. I was beyond tears at that point. I was mad. I was big mad. I took care of my necessary hygiene and marched directly to our division officer's office. I spilled the story, and his eyebrow raised as he comprehended that I literally felt physically unsafe in a confined space with this person. He spoke to the sailor who'd been with us in the space, who quietly and without drama confirmed what had happened, and that PO2 was summarily disciplined and ultimately removed from our division entirely. I never had to work with him again. I realized that maybe sexual harassment was at least better than violent aggression. Either way, both were obviously just part of being a female in the military. However, another part of being female in the military was that a lot of the time, more often than not, my officers had my back. Aside from the super toxic lieutenant who watched me get assaulted right on his desk and laughed, I might add he was married with 5 children, 2 of whom were girls. Every individual in my direct chain of command was professional, compassionate, and supportive. When that same lieutenant lost his mind on me, screaming in my face for a personal decision I made that had nothing to do with my professional duties, he was formally reprimanded by our division officer, who was, at the time, ironically and gloriously enough, a female warrant officer. When a watch officer on shore duty reprimanded me for pumping breast milk in an empty office after having my oldest son and suggested I pump in the head, again, the bathroom, our ironically and gloriously female command master chief sent him a memo from her office and requested that he eat his lunch in the bathroom. When he angrily refused, she asked why then did my baby have to have his food pumped in a bathroom. He acquiesced. I got the empty office back, and she even threw in a mini fridge for storing the milk, citing her similar decision to both start a family and breastfeed over a decade earlier while on active duty. For all its faults, the military hosts a tight-knit community of women that have each other's backs. I served from 2003 to 2007. I have no doubt that the environment has continued to change for the better. For the most part, overt sexual harassment, touching, and aggression towards female sailors were not really tolerated when I served, but a lot flew under the radar and wasn't officially handled. I have to believe the incessant reporting that my fellow female shipmates and I provided helped move that needle. Also, society was entirely different 20 years ago. It only takes a quick Google search for interviews with female artists, musicians, and actresses to see how they were treated and talked to at the time, and on camera. Girls Gone Wild was in full swing. Women were absolutely being subjugated right out in the open. To be a woman in the military was signing up to sacrifice your time, energy, and potentially life and limb in service to your country, and it also meant signing up for harassment and humiliation. It's pretty infuriating to think of now. Back then, it just seemed like part of the gig. So was it worth it? I met incredible people, including my husband and some of my good friends. I learned so much. I've probably forgotten more than many people will ever know about ships, antennae, radio equipment, computers, naval code and lore, and ancient seafaring code and lore. I joined a prestigious brotherhood and sisterhood when I donned that uniform and worked every day on one of the largest floating warships in the world. I was badass, and I liked it. I learned to roll with the punches and to throw some of my own. I like to think that those of us who donned that female uniform were even more badass than our male counterparts because we weren't just fighting the enemy. We were sometimes fighting our fellow sailors for respect and dignity. and I made it. I proudly served. I did some really cool stuff. I was awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal twice and even got to do some ultra cool off-the-books classified stuff. I held my own among the men in uniform and even eked out some begrudging respect from a lot of them. So was it worth it? Hell yeah. Do I wish I could have just done my job every day without the inappropriate behavior from some men? Hell yeah. Would I do it again? Hell yes, 1,000 times over. In August of 1963, 60 years and 9 months ago, President John F. Kennedy famously stood in front of the freshman class of the U.S. Naval Academy and said, "Any man who may be asked in this century what he did to make his life worthwhile, I think can respond with a good deal of pride and satisfaction, I served in the United States Navy." Or woman, Mr. President, or woman. I've shared a lot about my military service, the good and the bad, and in the coming weeks, I'll be sharing some stories of brave men and amazing writers who have shared their perspective from the combat zone. You won't want to miss these insightful, sometimes poetic, often heart-wrenching stories from the trenches. As always, if you'd like to contribute your story to the podcast, you can email me at thelightattheotherside@gmail.com or go to my website, melissacorrigan.com, and contact me that way. I highly recommend you hop on Medium and head to the publication Served to check out more stories from veterans. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.